And welcome back. This is another episode of Studio CPO. This is Stephen Buck. It's my honor to serve the Care Providers Oklahoma Association as the president and CEO. And I am absolutely thrilled about my guest today, Oklahoma's Governor Mary Fallon. She served prior to Governor Stitt's administration, and I had the unique opportunity late in the term to serve as a member of her cabinet. And so it's great to have a chance to interview my boss. Governor Fallon, thank you for joining me.
Oh, good to see you again, Secretary Buck. I like to still call you that, but you did a great job as our cabinet secretary and overseeing so many of our important functions of the state. And I'm thrilled that you're where you're at now, still helping Oklahomans, and especially with an important topic as long-term care and health care needs. And I'm glad to see you're still actively engaged.
Well, I certainly am, and it was an honor to serve in your administration. We may talk a little bit about some of the things that we wrestled with, both when we were working for you, but also in terms of long-term care. I know you have some personal insight into that I might want to visit a little bit about, but most of my listeners probably know you as Governor Fallon because of the friendship we developed. I know that there was a story well before you became Governor Fallon, well before you became State Rep Fallon. I mean, you had a tremendous lineage of service in the state. So for our listeners, why don't you share a little bit about your pathway to elected office?
Well, I grew up in a small town, Tempsa, Oklahoma, graduated from college and from OSU, and started my first jobs in public service in the state of Oklahoma, working at various state agencies. And when I was in my late 20s, my dad decided to run for mayor of the town. It didn't pay anything, but he was very involved in the community, and he was elected when I was 28. By the time I was 29, he passed away. He had a heart attack, passed away. And then they asked my mother, who was unelected, to step in and be the mayor, which I didn't realize really until I got older that that was really unusual. I mean, they passed over the vice mayor of the city council and asked my mother to step up to serve, and she did, which is remarkable after you lose a spouse, and she was elected on her own. So both my mother and father were mayors of Tecumseh. They were very involved in our small town, and I just learned public service and the importance of helping people. And my mother was a social worker. My dad worked for the Employment Security Commission and helped people with unemployment and getting jobs. So that just piqued my interest in public service.
You know, we had a chance when we worked together specifically. There was a juvenile justice campus in Tecumseh. And before it became a juvenile justice campus, it actually was Girlstown. Girlstown, Oklahoma. And I believe that historically, you actually did some frontline work with some of the young women there who had become disconnected from their families and might be struggling with behaviors. I mean, your level of service goes down to that person-to-person type of engagement.
Well, so the story is that when I was younger, my mother would say, if you don't behave, which I always was a good girl, I never got in trouble, but she said, I'm going to send you to Girlstown. It was always a joke in our family.
Which was just right around the corner from where you lived, right?
It was about 10 blocks, but it was a juvenile detention facility for girls 18 and under. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of the joke around town. But then by the time I was in college, I needed a summer job, and I got a summer job working at Girlstown. And I was a camp counselor and really was pretty naive to what the girls were there for. I just, like I said, I was a pretty clean-cut girl and just didn't know girls got in trouble like that. And it was kind of a shock to my system, the way I was treated by some of the girls as their counselor. But it was a great experience. And then when I became governor, it was a great opportunity and blessing for me to be able to work to encourage the legislature to give us a bond issue to make the modern changes that we needed to make in the structure and the delivery of care to taking care of our juveniles in our detention system, which later became a boys and a girls juvenile facility, and to rebuild it into a more accommodating state-of-the-art facility for our youth.
You know, I'm glad you touched on that, and this is just a sidebar note experientially. The noise of politics that it is, we often lose sight of some of the really hallmarks of progress that have been made, and you touched on it. If you're not familiar with the campus at Tecumseh, the current juvenile justice is perhaps the nicest juvenile justice system in the country. And that was in large part due to your championing. And so just a little shout out to the folks at OJA for the work that they do. So you served state house member, served as a lieutenant governor, served in Congress, came back the first female elected governor of Oklahoma. That extraordinary service and extraordinary barrier busting that you did as you went through the years. If I remember right, campaigning was always near and dear to your heart, especially getting out among the voters, not what we think of in campaigns today where you go out and do the slick digital media buys. You liked going out and seeing people. And so through your time of service, what are some of the things you learned about Oklahomans that have always been at the back of your mind when you think about when you travel and you describe Oklahomans to those you come in contact with? What are those traits?
Well, I think that campaigning has changed tremendously mm-hmm. from the time I actually ran for my first office when I was 35 years old, and I had a three-year-old child. Yes. And after I started campaigning, unbeknownst to me, 2 months into my race, I thought I had the flu, and I was still campaigning. I went to the doctor and found out I didn't have the flu. I was expecting a second child, which was a nice surprise, but unexpected. So I had my son between my primary and my general election.
That's remarkable timing.
It's crazy, because this was back in 1990. I mean, there were hardly any women in office, mm-hmm. much less a Republican conservative pregnant woman running for office was a no-no, per se. I got lectured by many people I shouldn't be doing what I was doing, but I did, because I felt my heart. That's what I wanted to do, to serve the people of Oklahoma. And I kept going on with what I had started. But anyway, I guess what I've learned over the time, especially as time has changed, and I think a lot of people these days are concerned about politics, concerned about what do you believe, what do you not believe? Do people really have my best interests in mind? Are they self-serving? And what's true, what's not true? Is that back in those days, it was a high-touch, personal campaign to where you went out among the people, and I did that. Mm-hmm. I walked door to door, even pregnant with my second child, campaigning and meeting people on their household porch steps and talked to them about, you know, it's an old cliche, but basically about kitchen table issues, mm-hmm. about finances, about schools, about education, about healthcare, you know, transportation, infrastructure, you know, jobs, opportunities, all different things we used to talk about. I think we still do to most extent, but there are huge issues these days besides all that. And I think that high touch and getting out and traveling from community to community, and I did go to all 77 counties every time I campaigned, if I was running for statewide office, many times. Mm-hmm. I went to all the different things I could think of to, you know, meet people where they were and to listen and to hear what they had to say. And hopefully go back and draft the type of policies that would make a difference.
You know, I think to follow up a little bit on that, and I'll point again, politics has become very polarized in nature. It's the way that issues and candidates are marketed. But there is really a unique fabric to Oklahomans, I believe. I think that they are hardworking people who want a chance to make a honest wage for an honest living. It had to be very inspirational to represent those values as you were elected to do, both at the State House as well as in D.C.
Well, I've always been very partial to Oklahoma and always felt like, and I used to say, it was the greatest state in the nation, because I thought our people did work hard. They did always seem to have a sense of community everywhere you went. The spirit that I would see of community volunteerism, the businesses that would invest and continue to add jobs and opportunities, important issues people look at like healthcare concerns, healthcare delivery, the school systems. I always felt like that Oklahomans took care of their own Oklahomans and would actively engage and be vocal when they needed to be, but yet not go out and cause these massive demonstrations you see in some other states,
right?
And be disruptive more than helpful in issues. But I always felt like we lived in a safe, secure, patriotic democracy in our state that appreciated law enforcement and public service and other things. And those things seem to be losing a little bit across the nation.
Yeah, I would agree.
Those values. Yeah.
We mentioned earlier Tecumseh. For those who are listening who may not know where Tecumseh is, probably best described as, 10 miles south of Shawnee? Is that a pretty fair description?
Right.
But it is a rural community, by and large. Feels very rural when you visit there. So one of the things I'm really interested in, your perspectives, is from your lens, what are the critical elements that are necessary to preserve rural life in Oklahoma? Having worked at the Capitol since 1997, I know that there is a very strong rural sentiment, and rightfully so. What do we need to do as a state to make sure that we represent the continued growth of our larger population centers, but also value what life is like in the rural parts of our state?
Well, not only myself, but my husband, Wade Christensen, and I both grew up in small rural communities. He grew up in Thomas, Oklahoma, grew up fourth-generation farmer. Dad had some small businesses there, and Wade worked on the farm growing up and moved to the city after college and practices law now. But both of us appreciate rural communities, and we still go back on occasion to see our relatives in those towns. But I think providing opportunity. If you don't have the ability to make a living, to support your family, to have jobs, have services, have a good education system, have access to health care, even the long-term care for those who have parents that are elderly, which was important to me in Tecumseh with my mother, and good infrastructure. You have to have good sewer, good water, access to public utilities. Internet is important to rural Oklahoma. And even housing, affordable housing. But there is a great quality of life to be had in rural communities. And, of course, safety. I think these days, safety, especially when you talk about the problems we have on our borders, is a very big issue with all the crime that we know could come into our state, that we always have safe communities to live in. But jobs and opportunity, workforce. If you don't have the workforce, you're not going to be able to keep your businesses open. And during my term as governor, I had a national initiative called America Works. It was about education, training for the jobs for tomorrow, not only for what we've had, but looking into the future. What skills do we need to be able to fulfill those jobs and keep our businesses open?
I would just add, I recall that when the history books are written on your terms of office that you had in the governor's office, there will be a very long chapter or chapters about your embracing and your team's embracing of workforce and how critical that was. And I specifically remember from the governor's council, some of the work that we did there, the ecosystems that we talked about and how important it was to create an economy that lifted all Oklahomans, whether you chose to live in a community of 250 or you wanted to live in a metro area of 1 million. We needed to create opportunity in both.
That's right. And the cabinet did a great job of, we basically surveyed businesses and asked them, what do you need? What skill sets do you need? And then we went and talked to the colleges and the high schools and the vo-techs. We included everybody at the table. We brought them together many times in big groups. And we would sit down and figure out the game plan for our statewide Oklahoma Works program. And then made sure that we were offering those type of skill sets and education courses, vocational courses, to meet the needs of whatever the workforce was. And, you think back about how we used to use Polaroid cameras or digital cameras. Now we use our cell phones.
Exactly.
And how much technology's changed. And, I remember back when I first started campaigning, I had a plastic box with note cards. I wrote down people's names and addresses to go talk to and if they would vote for me or not. Now it's all computerized. It's on a laptop. It's on your, iPad or whatever. When technology changes, whatever it might be, you have to keep up with those skill sets and whatever the latest technology is or workforce needed to fill those jobs.
Yep.
Same thing with healthcare, especially.
Absolutely. And, COVID has created a tremendous, the pandemic created a tremendous crunch in workforce, and I'm glad some of that infrastructure was laid early to be prepared to do that, because it is, my members would tell you that other than reimbursement, workforce is their number one pressing need. Now, I mentioned earlier when the book is written on your service, there will be chapters on workforce. There will also be significant commentary over your management of what became a very, very divisive time due to budget challenges in our state. And without going into all of the background and all the political forces, I mean, it was a complicated period of time. But you managed it. And in managing it, you had to make hard decisions. From a leadership perspective, for my listeners who are not interested in whether it was a pro-Democrat, pro-Republican, any of that, just from a leadership perspective, what kind of got you through that period of time, and what leadership lessons were you able to engage during a period that was historically extremely challenging budgetarily for our state?
Well, in the time you're talking about, I was in Congress back during the national economic bust, mm-hmm. and the housing market collapsed, the banks collapsed, the oil industry collapsed. That was back in 2008, 2009. My election started 2010, took office January 2011. We had a $500 million shortfall in our budget. The day I took office, and you might remember me saying this, we had $2.03 in our savings account.
And
that was it.
That's not exaggeration. You can pull the...
No, I got the records.
You can pull the Office of State Finance or OMES or whatever acronym. That was what our state had in reserve.
So it was a very tough time for the state. And it was a tough time for the nation, but it was a tough time for Oklahoma. We were fortunate enough that during the first 2-3 years of my office, that the price of oil and gas went up to over $100 a barrel. I think it was $127 at the highest. That was great. So at one point in time, we'd gone from having $2.03 to having a half a billion in savings. And then about 2013, the market crashed again, and the price of oil dropped to 27, mm-hmm. from 127 or so to down to around 27. The market crashed. The housing industry changed. Everything was changing economically. And so we went through years, about 3 years, of having, I think the first year was $700 million shortfall to $900 million. The biggest we ever had was $1.2 billion shortfall out of a $7-plus billion budget for the state. So that was like a 30% decrease in funding for the state of Oklahoma. So we had to make some really tough choices. You can't spend money you don't have. We had to balance our budget. State of Oklahoma by our constitution. Unlike the federal government, we can't produce money. So the agency heads and, of course, all the other people in administration had to work on how do we basically consolidate some services, how do we find efficiencies, how do we use technology even to make things more cost efficient, and we had to make cuts. Mm-hmm. And there were cuts that had to be made to different agency budgets because we had to balance the budget, and it was tough. Towards the third year, it just came to a time with a $1.2 billion budget out of the $7-plus billion, almost $8 billion. I said, okay, we got to do something different. We cannot keep going down this trajectory of tough times mid-2015, 2016, 2017. So we started looking at ways that we could help enhance our revenue. We didn't have enough revenue coming into the state. One of the things we hadn't done in the state of Oklahoma, we hadn't adjusted our gasoline tax. I think it was like 40 years at that point in time. So one of the proposals we put forward was raising the gasoline tax by 3 cents. Mm-hmm. 3 cents. Because our roads and bridges had about $1 billion of infrastructure needs of crumbling bridges, crumbling roads, etc. That was one of the things that we did. Cigarettes and smoking, we adjusted our cigarette tax in the state of Oklahoma. We had one of the highest smoking rates in our nation, and we had some of the highest Medicare costs, because we had poor health outcomes. Mm-hmm. We ranked 49th in health outcomes when I took office. By the time I left, we'd improved to 43rd, and to move that much in that short period of time, even for other states, was unheard of. I was just reading a report about that not too long ago, about how remarkable it was that we made such great improvements because we took steps to improve our health, to save money and costs and improve services in our state. But you're right, Steve, it was a very difficult time. Now, I'm pleased to say that after we took some other steps and consolidated some agencies and made more efficiencies and different things, eliminated a lot of boards and commissions. By the time I left, we were able to give Governor Stitt $500 million, half a billion dollars in savings, even though we went through those tough times.
And I think I was part of the team for the tail end of those troubles. It had started to emerge by the time I joined the cabinet. But what I tell you I admired about your leadership is you had a very strong goal orientation, and you constantly stayed working towards what you knew the goal was to be, which was to stabilize our state so that we would avoid the ebbs and flows that was tied to an energy economy. And that's the leadership lesson that I wanted to articulate for my listeners is you had a very clear goal, which was to stabilize. You asked your team to be passionate about that pursuit of the goal. You sold that goal every opportunity you could. And when there were naysayers,
You bet.
You continued to go back on, this is the goal we are going to pursue.
It's what we had to do. And I will tell you, I am 5 years out of office. To this day, Oklahoma has a record savings account. And they would not have had a savings account, at least not to the extent we had, if we hadn't have fixed it. And it was tough. Mm-hmm. Like I always tell my own children, you'll have 50% of people love you, 50% that hate you. It's just the way things are. Yeah. But if you're going to make the tough decisions that you know is right to put you on the right path for success, you have to be the person that steps up and says, I'm going to fix it.
Right. And I would just translate for listeners what that means. I believe in the long-term care sector is if we value our ability to lift care for residents, we establish those goals for what we want and you work towards those relentlessly. And so I just wanted to acknowledge I had an inner view as to what that looked like and wanted to acknowledge that. So shifting from that real quick, I ask all of my guests these final two questions. And so I'll start prepping up towards the end of our conversation that way. So when times get tough, when you're challenged with a difficult decision, whether it's during your period of elected office or whether it's your volunteer work or wherever you're doing, and you have to go to the well and grab onto some truth to get you through there, is there a specific leadership axiom, maybe a scripture, maybe a lesson from one of your mentors that you always anchor yourself in?
Well, if I go through a really tough time, and I went through a lot of tough times my whole career, and even personally, personal challenges, prayer, I mean, it's where I always start.
Yeah.
And that was always very important to me, and I used prayer a lot, and even with my cabinet, you might remember.
I do.
We had cabinet meetings and with my staff at the beginning of meetings. But, I mean, that's first of all. And I guess I always had believed that you just can't give up just because it's tough, or if people are coming against you because you suggest a couple of ideas, I mean, you certainly got to listen. And maybe they do have a better idea, but maybe they don't know all the details of, you know, it's easy to say, let's do this, let's do that, but you don't know the ramifications that you touch this, it touches that. And there's a cascade effect of things it can affect. So making the best decision you can based with the knowledge that you have. And then if something doesn't work, then you can change directions and go a different course and fine-tune it if you had to. There were a couple of axioms I used to use a long time ago. One was, it's just real simple. If you continue to think the way you've always thought, you'll continue to get what you've always got. Mm-hmm. It's real simple. And the other one was, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. So you got to know where you're going. You got to have a plan of action. You got to be strategic about it. You got to be intentional about it. You got to gather people around you that are smart and listen to them. There are a lot of people in leadership that never listen to their own people they bring around them. They just think, I know everything. I'm not going to listen to anybody else. And they're the ones who usually don't do well. Mm-hmm. But those who appreciate and respect others like yourself, who have wisdom and know their industries or know their specialty, whatever industry that might be or profession that might be, and then listen and let people do their jobs.
That's excellent advice. And certainly as we, our administrators and facilities manage their teams, sometimes your best care idea may come from your most junior, lowest paid employee.
You bet.
And if you aren't tuned into that, we might miss opportunities that will help us succeed beyond our wildest dreams.
And employees want to feel appreciated. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be overlooked. They don't want to be talked down to.
Yeah.
And sometimes people in management do that. They just think they're smarter than everybody. And
that's right.
And you have to be a leader, and you have to lead, and you have to provide the path forward, the road forward. But you do need to listen to other people and be respectful when you do.
All right, final question. And I really want to see where you ended up on your answer to this one. Because we, before we turned on the recorder, we had a chance to talk around this one a little bit. So you've had an extraordinarily accomplished career. You now have a wonderful family. Eight grandchildren?
Almost.
Almost eight grandchildren. I mean, that's a lot of really cool experiences in your life. Mm-hmm. And so you have been the benefactor of a lot of learned experience and earned experience, meaning you've had to live through some different things. So if you could go back, what would you want young Mary Fallon to know that you know now that she didn't know then? And you had an interesting angle on this.
Yes, I did have an interesting angle. And my angle was, if I knew everything back then when I was 35 years old, idealistic, thinking I can go out and change the world. And yes, I can do that just because no one else has ever done it. And because I had some other, you know, family challenges that might be challenging, you know, having young children. Mm-hmm. I didn't let any of that hold me back because I had a vision or a dream of things I wanted to get done in the state. But if I'd known all that, what I know now about politics, about social media, which we didn't have back then, about the internet, I might not run for office, but I'm glad I did, and I'm glad I had the opportunity. But in all seriousness, I would say it's hard for good people to step up and run mm-hmm. or to be in public service anymore because it's so easy to get on the internet and blindly criticize someone when you don't know all the facts and details. And there's so much false information on the internet, or even, frankly, on the news and the media. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I see things on the news and I think, oh my gosh, I can't believe you worded it that way because that's just not what happened.
And it breaks both ways, right? That's not Absolutely. Necessarily a partisan thing. You
no,
see it from both sides.
Both sides. I see it all the time. And it really bothers me, but you know, we live in what I think is the greatest nation in the world, but we have to hang on to it, and we have to hang on to the values that made our nation great, and if we don't, we'll lose it. But I think I know a lot more now than I did back when I was younger, but I'm glad I didn't know all those things when I was younger.
That is a very fair response. I think that's the appropriate time to acknowledge President Roosevelt's the man in the arena, or the person in the arena, I think. I'm very glad you stepped into the arena. Thank you for being willing to serve. Thank you for giving me incredible opportunity in my service to the state. And just thank you for spending a few minutes with me today. You've been very generous with your time.
Well, it's fun to see you, and I am grateful that you served in the administration. You contributed so much, and I'm thrilled that you're still serving other people because you have a lot to give.
And we're still at it. Governor, thank you. This is Stephen Buck signing off with Studio CPO.